on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 96-year-old Fred Stevenson of Porterville, California, originally from Great Falls, Montana. During World War II, he'd be stationed in Horam, England with the 95th Bomb Group. I know you joined the Army Air Corps because you wanted to fly, and you told us why it didn't work out that way and that you ended up in charge of packing parachutes. Did you come to enjoy that duty?
Oh, I enjoyed it. And sewing was part of the deal of taking care of parachutes. I had kind of a knack of sewing, and so I made different stuff, bags and stuff, sewing. Later on, when I got to England, after packing chutes for a while, they needed a sewing shop to fit flying clothes to the flying personnel. I don't know where they got the information, but I was picked to open this sewing shop. So they give me about five different other guys and about a dozen new sewing machines and a building and put me to work.
When was that you went across to England?
March in 1943. We went over in the Queen Elizabeth. And it was just overloaded. In fact, there were so many on board that they couldn't all sleep at the same time. My outfit was down in the cargo holds, and we slept in hammocks. And they were so close together, they were practically touching. And Queen Elizabeth went by herself without escort and depended upon her speed to keep away from the submarines. But they zigzagged the boat. And all the time, every time they'd get it level, they'd make another turn, and then our hammocks would start to turn, and they'd hit. And it was really a time. And then one of the big shafts that run the propellers went right through the cargo hold, and going at top speed, it just screamed. And we had that noise of all that screaming all the way for 5 days going over.
Yeah, that sounds like it's enough to drive you nuts. And, you know, most of the people, the people that I have on this show, we talk about war from an American perspective, and a lot of times we forget what the British people went through before America was ever involved in this war. But I bet when you got over there, you got a pretty palpable taste of what the Brits had been through.
Yes, we talked with a few of them, although where I was stationed in England was out in the farm area, and there was very few people around other than when we were on leave going to London and stuff. And of course, that was quite an experience in itself.
Yeah, tell me about that. What did you see there, and were there some reasons to be concerned that you might be in danger?
Of course, they were still bombing London quite regularly there, but being young and new experience, we weren't really afraid. Although I was in a little hotel in London when the bombers came over, and we got kind of shook up, and it kind of brought to the fact that we were in a war. And then later on, we seen the buzz bombs from our base going over. And then later on, I was in London when a couple of the rockets hit. And that was really scary because the concussion of those things going off would kill people. There would be nothing wrong with them to look at them, but the concussion would kill them. And that was real scary.
So those were the V-2s?
Yes, they were V-2s.
How close were you to where they hit? What did you see?
It was, not real close, but we were within walking distance of where they hit and seen what happened to the people when they were subject to the concussions. And, of course, they did tremendous damage, too.
So you walk by and you see the damage that's done and you see people scattered everywhere, just dead on the ground?
One time is the only time that I actually witnessed this, but it was enough to give me an impression that there was a war going on.
And what's to stop that from happening to you?
Well, like I say, we were young at that time. It didn't have a real bad impression on us.
Those of us who weren't born when all this was going on, we just understand World War II from history. We know who won. So it's hard for us to, I think, realize that you guys were in this war at a time where you didn't know what was going to happen. You didn't know if your side was going to win. And I imagine being there in England, there were probably some days where you had significant doubts that the Allies were going to win.
Yes. At one time, the Germans were talking about invading England. And we had to keep a weapon with us as we went around our regular duties and stuff. And every once in a while, of course, we'd be strafed by German planes. And one time when we first got over there, our airfield wasn't ready for us. And we were put in another airfield in tents to wait the time to go. One morning, always way early in the morning, about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, they had radio or loudspeakers in our tents. And here come across said that no one was to leave their tent under any circumstances until further notice. Of course, they didn't explain what was the matter. Time went by, and we got daylight, and we were all supposed to leave. And it was about 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning before we were allowed to leave. And come to find out, the Germans had dropped what they called anti-personnel bombs over our area, and they were little bombs that they would hit the ground and they would kind of open up. They called them butterfly bombs. And if you touch one of them walking, it would blow your leg off. Of course, they had to get a special crew of Englishmen to come in and defuse these bombs before we could leave our tents. Wow. But that was about the closest we came to being hurt.
And all this time, you're still pumping out these parachutes and checking them out all the time. How intense was that? Can you give us maybe the scope of that operation with the parachutes and what the significance of what you were doing was?
They had to be hung up and dried and every so often, and we weren't allowed to put our name like we did in the States of who packed them, but we just put a piece of paper with our initials on, and it was a great feeling. Every once in a while, some flyer would came in and say, whose initials are so-and-so? And, of course, at first we wouldn't know what they wanted, but then he'd say it worked, meaning that the parachute worked with our initials in it. Of course, we never did get anybody come in and say it didn't work.
Again, just so we understand, this may seem very basic to you, but what was that whole process from start to finish with the parachutes? What steps did you have to go through to make sure that it was going to work and that these guys are in good hands?
There's a special routine of folding a chute, and we had long tables. We strung them out there, and they had a certain way of folding them and putting them into the pack. And then the last thing was a little pilot chute that worked on a spring that you put in at the very last, and when you pulled the ripcord, this pilot chute would jump out and pull the big chute out of its pack. We had inspectors that checked the chutes on the guys that's packing them all the time, make sure that they never got lazy or didn't go through with them. Mm-hmm. But I was the inspector for quite a time before I was called to operate the sewing shop.
How much responsibility did you feel? Because really, if you don't do your job right, someone could die, right? I mean, that's not an exaggeration, is it?
I was, as an inspector, I was real strict. I wouldn't allow anything to get by me. And after you get the crew of packers under that idea, they knew better than try and pull something short. So we had no problem that way. Although one thing happened, when they flew the 17s over from the States over to England, and they went around about way and went across jungles, so they put what they call a jungle pack instead of the seat cushion on the seat chutes. And in case they forced down over jungles or someplace and got hurt, they would have some way of taking care of themselves. And in those was a little tube of narcotics. And when they got over to England, we took those jungle chutes off and dispensed the stuff and put a regular seat cushion on. We had to keep our parachute shop open 24 hours a day, and so different guys would take night duty. And then one time, one of the fellas said he volunteered to do the night duty, which was kind of a relief to us to stay up overnight. I came over to check something in the parachute department, and here I seen this guy sleeping, and his eyes were big and everything like that. Here he was using this dope that came off of these jungle packs, and he was having a good time until I caught him. So from that time on, we disposed of all that narcotics and stuff.
You know, I neglected to ask you about something. I think you had a lot of incentive to come back home from overseas, because you got married right before you went over, didn't you?
On the way overseas, I said I went to Walla Walla first, and then I was stationed in Sioux City. A buddy of mine said, "Why, I'm going with a young lady. He says she's got a sister. Why don't you go with us on a double date?" And I said, "No, I don't want anything to do with that." But he kept talking, and so finally I broke down. So we went this just before Christmas. Here my girlfriend to be was a nurse, just fresh out of nursing school. As I walked in their house, she came down, there's a two-story house, came down the stairs, and it looked like she just got out of bed. She was, well, turned out that she was on night shift, taking care of patients, and here she hadn't had any sleep for the time we went. We really fell for each other, and 30 days later, we were married.
30 days. Were you hesitant at all? I mean, you know that you're going to be going overseas pretty soon. Did that?
I wasn't too crazy about getting married, but she insisted, so I went along with it. It was a gamble, you know, going overseas and war and going on, but it was worth it. I liked her well enough that I didn't want her to get away from me.
And while you were in England, you found out there was somebody else was going to be waiting for you?
That's right. She was pregnant, and in fact, she had joined joining the service as a nurse. Her papers hadn't gone through all the way yet. But when she found out she was pregnant, of course, that took care of that. And my son was 6-7 months old before I even found out I had a son. And it was a funny thing. The mail, even telegrams, were hard to get through. The boy was born about a week or so before I even found out about it, and I got two telegrams the same day telling that I was a father of a son. Of course, all my friends demanded I have they get a cigar, and I didn't smoke, so I went down and bought a box of cigars and handed them out. But I even tried to smoke one myself, but that didn't go over very well.
Was it ever a concern of yours that son might grow up without a father, that you might not make it back home?
No, we never thought of that. It was, he always had the idea he was going to get back. Although the personnel that were lost, flying personnel from the bombing group I was at, was terrible. There was 10 men in each B-17. Sometimes we would send out 18 planes, and maybe 8 of them would come back. So there was a lot of guys, and we were subject to seeing that. And we got to the point where we didn't make friends with the flying personnel, because they never lasted that long.
I guess that, in a way, makes your job even more important. I mean, right, if there's that many planes being shot down, and some of those guys don't have a chance to bail out, but that's a lot of guys who are bailing out and need those parachutes to work.
Many times they never had a chance to bail out. The planes blew up and everything like that. It really hurt to see what was going on, the amount of young fellas that didn't come back from their flights.
Yeah, and when you consider that the 95th Bomb Group flew 334 missions between May of 1943 and May of 45, you can imagine how frequently those losses occurred. We're going to explore more of Fred Stevenson's World War II experiences when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.